From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour is made every evening, sometime around 5:30 or 6 p.m. President Donald Trump holds his coronavirus task force briefings, which typically devolve into a testy question and answer session with journalists. The president opens the briefings with a prepared set of remarks. Sometimes he steps aside to ask members of the task force, like Dr. Anthony Fauci, to make some comments. Then he comes back, offers his own opinions, and takes questions. And these Q&As tend to run for 60, sometimes 90 minutes, sometimes more. And this has led to a challenge for news organizations. Should they air the briefings in their entirety? The president regularly makes inaccurate statements about sensitive medical information. He lies about who's infected or how the containment is going. And some organizations have decided that the misinformation is too much. It's harmful, and it contributes to public confusion and division. As a result, some organizations don't cover the news conferences live. They wait and analyze what was said, looking for the most important elements to report. Other organizations carry the prepared remarks and the remarks of doctors like Fauci and Birx, but they cut away when the president begins his Q&A. And still others are committed to airing these events fully. What's the best approach during a crisis? Conservative author Tom Nichols says these events must be carried wholly to allow the American public to see how their leaders behave in an emergency. Nichols is the author of the best-selling book, The Death of Expertise, and he's a regular contributor to publications like USA Today, The Atlantic, and more. And he's decided that if many journalists will no longer cover the full briefings, he will. So every day he digs in for the long haul, documenting what he's witnessing. In The Atlantic, Nichols writes, quote, "Each of these presidential therapy sessions corrodes us. In a time of crisis, we should be finding what is best in ourselves. Trump, instead, invites us to join a daily ritual. His followers are delighted by yet more vulgar attacks on the media and the Democrats, and all of us, angry or pleased, become more like Trump, because just like the president, we end up thinking about only Trump, instead of our families, our fellow citizens, our healthcare workers, or the future of our country. We are all forced to take sides every day, and those two sides are always Trump and everyone else," end quote. So why do this at all? Well, he's joining us to explain this hour. My guest is Tom Nichols, the author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Welcome back to the program. How are you? And that's not like just a congenial question. How are you actually doing?
Well, thank you, Evan, and thanks for having me back. And I'm fine. Yes, it is strange that now we say to each other, "How are you? How are you doing?" And we really mean it.
Yes.
It's always been kind of a joke that people say, "How are you?" And nobody really wants to know. But you know, we've changed, and when we ask that question, it's a real question. So, like everybody else, I'm hunkered down. I live in Rhode Island. We're in between two hotspots in New York and Boston, and we're just sort of muddling along and doing our best here in this little state. So far so good. So knock on wood. And we're just, taking it day by day at this point, like everybody else.
Well, let me reintroduce you for listeners who are not as familiar with your work, because this is where I think it's important that they do understand your expertise. You taught international relations and Russian affairs at Dartmouth and Georgetown. You were personal staff for defense and security affairs in the U.S. Senate to the late Senator Hines of Pennsylvania. And I know, this is controversial to say this, but you're still a professor at the Naval War College, though you're not here repping them. You're here repping you. Fair?
Fair. I am. My day job is at the Naval War College, where I teach national security affairs, but I don't represent the Navy or the U.S. government.
Okay. You've got a long history, not only of knowledge in those areas, but you were sort of robbed by Jeopardy. That, when you were on the show Jeopardy, didn't you win five in a row? And then that was at a time where you couldn't come back if you won everything in a week?
Well, I not only did I play back when they forced you to retire at five, although that does let you call yourself an undefeated Jeopardy champion, so I'm one of the five timers. I actually had to win six to get on five because in my last show there was an error in one of their questions, and Jeopardy was actually wrong about something, which really, is like a disturbance in the force, So they invited me back because at that point I'd only won four. So I came back, and by the skin of my teeth, I won one more. So I'm a five-time winner who had to win six. But I was even in the Hall of Fame for a while as one of the 100 best players, but apparently my rank was 100 because I got smoked in the Ultimate Tournament about 10 or 15 years ago. So I had a good run, but it's over, and
So,
my number's been retired.
you weren't watching Jennings and Holzhauer and Rutter thinking, you know, if only the rules had been different, that would have been me on that stage.
To me, James Holzhauer ruined the game.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's not a game for professionals. The beauty of Jeopardy is that it's finding out that your neighbor, your mailman, the guy who works on your car, the transit cop. There was a transit cop who was one of the greatest champions of the game. It's not meant for, number shark Las Vegas odds makers to see if they can beat the board. And I think it tells you something that the person who finally beat Holzhauer wrote her master's thesis on Jeopardy. And at that point, that's just a game. I actually said a while back when this happened, watching Holzhauer play was about as much fun as watching the sports book room at Caesars. I
Card
understand
sharks are
that
people
people,
too, Tom.
yeah, I understand that people, manipulate the numbers and play that way, but I'm not interested in watching them do that. So I was glad that Jennings finally won because, of course, he was older than everybody else too. So it was, old guys with real knowledge won the day. So that's a good way for me to go out.
All right, well, let's get to why you're here. And I'm going to start by quoting James Poniewozik, who was a longtime writer for Time, now writing for the New York Times, about what the news media should and should not be doing, or at least how they should be viewing these presidential daily briefings. Here's what Poniewozik writes in a piece called President Trump's Primetime Pandemic. He writes, "The president is able to seize primetime, abetted by networks who, knowing that his briefings have made objectively false claims, fall back on the easy answer that when the president speaks during an emergency, that is by definition news. And it's true. If the president is spreading misinformation, deliberately or otherwise, in a public health crisis, that is absolutely news. But that doesn't mean that airing it live is a service," end quote. So that's the distinction I want you to start with here, Tom. What Poniewozik is saying, and what I hear a lot of people now saying, Jay Rosen from NYU, among many others, is that, yes, it's news when the president speaks about just about anything. And yes, it's news if he lies or spreads misinformation. But it's also a could be news and a disservice to carry it live, as opposed to news and we will provide the service of vetting it fully and covering it later. How do you feel about that?
I'm torn because I agree with everything that Poniewozik and Rosen have said, but there's a couple of things. First, if this were still the old days of three major networks, I would have encouraged those network heads to get together and say, "Look, we have to have a common policy here on what's in the public interest, and either we carry them or we don't." But there's an imbalance here because Fox is always going to carry these things. The internet somehow will always stream it. The best distinction I've heard was actually Olivier Knox, who is a White House reporter, and he said, the media has to cover these. It doesn't necessarily have to broadcast them." And I think a good alternative solution here would be to say that because the president is abusing the public trust, because the president is hijacking the airwaves, because we are good citizens who believe that when the president speaks, we should hear what the president of the United States has to say, that there should be an understand these are always run on C-SPAN in their entirety. But they don't have to displace all the other programming unless the White House says this is a national emergency, short term, we need 20 minutes of your airtime because we're about to go to war or something. So I think part of the problem here is that the president, who the only thing the president is good at is marketing, and he has decided to do this. Now, with all that said, I know that as a political matter, I think a lot of people have concern about unearned media that is working to his advantage. I am less concerned about that because I actually think these briefings are working against him. I think that they are corroding his ratings. I think that they are hurting him and putting him out there. I think his own staff would be relieved if he would just stop doing this. So I guess my bottom line on this is I think a group of us, journalists, analysts, commentators, political scientists, policy experts, we need to watch simply, as I said in a piece in USA Today a few weeks ago, I watch just to bear witness. I mean, at this point, I'm watching out of sheer stubbornness, and because I think someone should. But I think it would be okay if the average citizen at this point said, you know, this is not news. But there is one other thing, and this really worries me. I don't want the media to get into the habit of saying that when the president talks, we sort of flip a coin and say, are we going to cover it or not cover it? Because one day we're going to have a president again who does not do this, and we will want the media to say, look, we don't judge. We do our duty here. The president speaks. We broadcast it. We put it on for you as a public service. I'm worried that we're getting that the media and the citizenry are getting used to tuning out the president of the United States. That's fine as long as Trump's president, I suppose. But at some point, you're going to undermine the office so badly. I mean, not, you know, the president's undermined his own office, but I mean the media and the public will just get used to not paying attention to the president, and that worries me.
Sure, and that's part of the larger conversation about this particular presidency. What are the long-term impacts in a post-Trump presidency world that are going to sort of corrode us? And maybe that's a part of a conversation for a different day, but sticking to the notion of these briefings here, you know, you say that you think they're actually hurting him. To be clear for listeners, you're not like a rhino. Well, you are now. You're not a conservative
no,
in name only.
I am not. I actually.
You're not a conservative
I am
in name
not,
only. Yeah.
I quit the Republican Party a while back, and I am one of the OG never Trumpers from the get go.
But you're a conservative.
Yeah, although, you know, it's interesting. I guess I'm struggling to determine what that means today. I'm a small C conservative. You know, limited efficient government, strong national defense, taxation close to the source of, you know, like local and state taxation, closer to the source of where money is earned. You know, these are things that were hardly controversial. I don't think of President Trump at all as a conservative. I don't think that, you know, tariffs and protectionism are conservative. I don't think that sucking up to Russia is conservative. I don't think that, you know, big government statist executive supremacy is conservative. So, you know, this is not a hard call for me to be at a remove from this administration, because this just doesn't reflect anything I believe in. I mean, I started writing the first pieces saying that I would not vote for Trump, and that however reluctantly I would actually vote for Clinton. And I did all the way back in 2015. So this isn't new for me.
Okay, but you voted for Mitt Romney, right?
I did. I did vote for Mitt Romney.
Maybe would again.
Well, unfortunately, no. I think
that's interesting.
Well, you know, I mean, I think Romney did a very principled thing during the impeachment. The problem is that up until the moment of the impeachment, Romney was and remains part of a Republican Party that now is basically just a cult of personality to enable one man. I mean, I think the Republican Party, as I knew it as a young man in the 80s and the 90s, I think is functionally dead. And I, from here on out, will always be an independent voter. I mean, it's sort of, you know, when you're a member of one party for 35 years, it's like being married, you know. It's I'm now divorced and will never marry again. I actually said a while back in a piece that in real life, I am divorced and remarried, and finding love again is easier than finding a party again.
Well, I want to listen to one of the clips from a recent White House briefing, and then I want to talk to you more about if you think this is actually hurting him, because I'm not so sure. But this is his exchange that a lot of people were talking about with a CBS News reporter named Weijia Zhang, and Weijia Zhang is challenging the president on, you know, whether he can really claim to have been ahead of this virus. Let's listen.
Same thing about you, that you should have warned them the virus was spreading like wildfire through the month of February instead of holding rallies with thousands of people. Why did you wait so long
to warn them? Who are you with?
And why did you not have social distancing until March 16th?
Who are you with?
I'm Weijia Zhang with CBS News.
So if you look at what I did in terms of cutting off or banning China from coming in.
Chinese nationals. But by the way, not Americans who are also
nice
from
easy,
China.
Nice and easy. Just relax. We cut it off. People were amazed. These gentlemen, everybody was amazed that I did it. We had 21 people in a room. Everybody was against it but me. Dr. Fauci said, had I not done that, perhaps tens of thousands, and maybe much more than that, people would have died. I was very early, very, very early. And we just saw, you saw Bret Baier making a statement. They had a debate well into February. And not even mentioned. It wasn't even mentioned, the Democrats. We were very early. Oh, I'm the president. And you know what I just did? And you know what I just...
And by the way, when you issued the ban, the virus was already here.
Okay, and you know how many people, when I issued the ban, how many cases of virus were in the United States when I issued the ban? Do you know the number?
No.
How many cases? Remember I said one person. How many cases were here when I issued the ban?
But tell did me. You know?
No. You have to do your research. How many?
I did my research. On the 23rd of March, you said you knew this was going to be a pandemic.
Can I tell you what?
Well,
I did know it. I did know it. All I have to do is look.
So you knew it.
Anybody knew it. Just, are you ready? How many cases were in the United States when I did my ban? How many people had died in the United States?
So do you acknowledge that you didn't think
Keep your voice down, please.
Spread?
Keep your voice down.
That's Donald Trump and Weijia Zhang from CBS News. So first of all, that clip there, if you don't watch these nightly briefings, that's pretty common, isn't it, Tom?
Well, that was my friend Bob Seska rates these on a 1 to 10 of crazy. And that was definitely going into the ultraviolet spectrum there of crazy exchanges. So that was worse than normal. But I also thought that was a great moment that the American public should see. I mean, I think that's really important for people to see. And this question of whether or not it hurts him, I have friends, you know, in real life, outside of, social media or radio or anywhere else. And they are very strongly pro-Trump. And even they will say, you know, I wish he wouldn't do that. I wish he wouldn't tweet. I wish he wouldn't do these, be insulting. I like what he does. And you can see them almost sweating with the caloric effort to make themselves stay on board when he does things like that. Now, his base loves those moments, but his base isn't – I mean, the truest thing Donald Trump ever said is that he can shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and not lose support. That we all laughed at him, but apparently he knew something about his own polling that we didn't. Those people are never going to change their minds, but there are millions of other people, I think, who need to see that and need to be confronted with the reality of what they're supporting. And I think for a lot of those folks, at least in my experience, it makes them deeply uncomfortable, and it should. I mean, that's an embarrassing, that when even the sound clip that you just, without seeing the visual, I saw that happen in real time. Even hearing it again makes you cringe in almost sympathetic embarrassment for the president, who is, it's just so it's so boyish, it's so childish, and this is the leader of a superpower during a national emergency. I think people shouldn't be able later on to say, "Oh, I didn't hear about it. I didn't see it." That's partly why I watch, so that when people later say to me, "Well, I don't know if that happened or I didn't see that," I can say, I saw it with my own eyes. Hmm. I'll tell you, it happened.
And you note pretty routinely that he will say things to the women reporters like, keep your voice down like he did, or calm down, just relax. Those are obviously sexist remarks, but that's a pretty common feature, isn't it?
Yes. He is not only rude and condescending to women, but it clearly, if you watch them, and this is where the visual, I think, is really important, he is terrified of women. Female reporters scare him to death, and you can almost see him calling on people like Yami Shalcinder, for example, or Paula Reed, and he's almost like he's steeling himself to see if he can do it. I think there is a part of him that starts these saying, this time I'm going to get through it. And by about 45 minutes, those of us who've been watching all these consistently, he can hold it together for about 20 or 25 minutes. By about 45 minutes in, he's completely at loose ends. And I agree with my friend P. Wehner at The Atlantic, who has referred to him as a deeply disordered personality. I think there's something deeply wrong with the president on an emotional or psychological level. And again, I think people need to see this. I think they need to take it in with their own eyes. Because it's really something, it's really astonishing to see. But yes, the abusiveness, the condescension toward women is startling every time.
Okay, but let's just talk a little bit about then what we're seeing in terms of the American reaction here. And I have been, I've tried to be clear on this program about what I think we need to be in a crisis, which is as apolitical or nonpartisan as we can be, because competence and leadership can come from many quarters during a crisis. And frankly, a crisis will reveal who's able to be competent. You've got, you know, and I've said this many times, but I'll say it again. We've had disastrous leadership that was either uninformed, intentionally lying, lazy. Bill de Blasio in New York City, going to the gym on the day that he says he's going to close them, but wants to get one more workout in, telling people the night before, go out to the bars, absolutely uninformed about the way the virus spreads. So Bill de Blasio in New York City, obviously the president and the White House spending 6 weeks telling people this was no big deal, it'll just go away. But then you've got, you know, Democrats and Republicans in different places doing really good work, like Mike DeWine in Ohio doing outstanding work. That's where my parents live, and I'm in touch with them all the time about what's going on in Ohio. So this isn't necessarily a political stripes thing. But when you look at the polling, it still reflects that way. So after 9/11, 2 weeks after 9/11, George W. Bush's approval rating for handling that crisis was 91%. It was just a remarkable number. Obviously, it didn't last forever, but that was a remarkable moment, a common enemy. And the American people wanted to rally sort of together and set things aside. Trump hasn't gotten higher than 60. He got 60 in one poll for handling the way he handled the virus. And he's back in the 40s. And some people are amazed that he's in the 40s. But at the same time, Tom, when we have these national crises, the American people tend to want to set aside politics and say, you know, forget that stuff. We're all one today.
They do. And Trump's making that impossible. And he's doing it to himself. He had a shortly after the coronavirus became a crisis, you know, instead of a looming problem, it became a no kidding, this is really happening crisis. He was getting a rally around the flag bump. Now, it was weak compared to what other presidents have gotten, but it was there. His polls were climbing.
Yeah.
And he just, you know, this is somebody who simply cannot take yes for an answer. He is a giant vat of grievance about everything. So he doesn't focus on the good news. He focuses on whoever's criticizing him. You know, and you're right, as if we all need more reasons to dislike Bill de Blasio. I mean, you know, his own city can't stand him. But he's not the president of the United States. What's been an interesting dynamic here, and I think it's also this is one silver lining, because I think it has been a healthy dynamic. People are actually paying attention to their governors and to their states. Federalism, American federalism, maybe this is where I'm a conservative, but American federalism is working the way it's supposed to work, which is that, you know, you are governed by the people who live closest to you, rather than by blanket regulations coming from Washington. Nonetheless, if you look at the polling, Dr. Fauci, vastly more trusted than Trump on this issue, even though the Trumper, you know, literati, the Trump media, Trump adjacent or Trump friendly media are trying to go after Fauci to blame him for the economic dislocation that is going to get worse. Governors get much higher marks than the president does, because they are doing a much better job. And as you say, that is both Republicans and Democrats. I think the president could have surfed some of that and had better numbers and occupied a more unifying place, but he's simply not capable of it. He is not built that way. Governor Hogan yesterday, this is a Republican governor, the president accused him of not knowing what's going on, not understanding what federal resources were available to him. And in a masterful moment of shade, Governor Hogan last night about 9:30 tweeted, I'm grateful to President Trump for sending us a list of federal labs and offering Maryland use of them for testing. Accessing these federal labs will be critical for utilizing the 500,000 tests we have acquired from South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that, you know, if you're, it is political malpractice of the first order. Let's leave aside, you know, national unity issues. If you're a Republican president and a Republican governor is able to shut you down and basically tell you to shut up and get out of the way, you know, I this is where I really doubt the people who say that he's getting a free ride off of this or getting a lot of good media, because that is a devastating response from a very popular Republican governor.
Yeah, Governor Hogan of Maryland. So, listeners, if you're on the phone or if you got emails, we'll take them in a moment here. I just want to type a couple of other things with our guest, Tom Nichols, who is the author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. He's written far and wide in this country, especially in the last 4 years, but recently he's been watching every single one of the nightly White House briefings, even if you aren't. Tom says someone has to document every minute, and as far as we can tell, Tom's mental health is still intact enough to do this interview with us. So, so listeners, we'll get to your comments in just a moment, but a couple more things here. So I noticed an interesting shift last week. So Tuesday was the day, Monday and Tuesday were the days that he was claiming to have total authority over states, that he could tell governors what to do. The states would have to follow him because the office of the president was absolute. Now, obviously that was wrong on the merits.
It was nonsense.
It was nonsense. It was wrong on the merits. But I think at least my sort of lay understanding of this, just guessing, is it reflects someone who really does think, well, I'm the president, I can do anything. Now, I think as the week went on and there was more talk about reopening, because we have to reopen in some kind of phases, we can't do this lockdown forever, I think something dawned on the president, which is that if he could then say, oh, okay, states, you're all in charge, we'll support you in what you decide, you're in charge, then he could stand back, and for the states that have phased reopenings and there's a spike in infections, he can then say, well, look, you had your own decision to make and you obviously reopened too early. And for the states that hang back and close and there's more economic disruption, he could tell the voters there, hey, I would have opened you up earlier, but your governor wouldn't do it. I feel like it's a big out for him. What do you think?
Yeah. But there's a couple of problems with your analysis, Evan. One is you are looking at this like a normal person. And I think the president is not a normal person in the way he perceives the world or processes information. Also, you are an intelligent person. And, you know, it will make, I suppose, some Trump supporters angry to hear this. But I really believe that President Trump is one of the least intelligent men in ever to hold that office. I mean, he just doesn't get it. He is not educable. I've known people who have tried to brief him, and they have said he literally cannot focus for more than a few minutes, and then he just starts talking or kind of wanders off into things. So imagine being the person trying to walk him through that as a political staffer to say, okay, Mr. President, you know, here's how, you know, you turn this to your advantage by giving the governors all that authority, let them take that. He can't help himself. He is as, some of the other, one of Trump's critics once put it really well. He said he's a poor man's image of what rich looks like. He's a weak person's image of what strong looks like. If you think about the competing claims, I am in charge, but it's all on you. There was actually a piece, I think, in the Times the other day that pointed out that people in his circle were actually trying to get him to where you are right now, to say, look, take enough authority to look like you're in charge, offload enough to the governors so that, you know, the hit is on them. He just doesn't know how to do it. His instinct is to say, you even hear it in the kind of verbal tics during his talks. I'm powerful. I'm in charge. I'm strong.
And then telling voters, liberate, 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 those tweets.
Yeah. I mean, he loves the language of strength, because I think it covers a lot of his own insecurity. He even uses these words in ways that make no sense. We're looking at that very strongly. That's not what that adverb means. You know, these are not real parts of speech. You know, we had a very powerful discussion about that, very strongly, very powerfully. So I think his instinct is to say, I'm the boss, I'm in charge. But just as in his business empire, he is a name at the top of a roster, and then there are people below him who manage all these things. And he doesn't want the responsibility. I mean, in this, as I keep saying, he's like a little boy. He wants to play the game. He wants to put the uniform on and play the game of being very strong. But then when it's time to take the consequences, I mean, this is a president who said, he literally said the words, I accept responsibility for nothing. I don't accept any responsibility at all.
Yeah.
That is a first in American presidential history to have the chief executive, the commander in chief, say, I don't accept any responsibility at all.
So two more quick questions and then we'll turn to our listeners. For a few weeks, journalists seem to be begging Tony Fauci, Dr. Fauci, into criticizing Trump, almost stoking a conflict. And there are critics who say Fauci should have walked off the stage numerous times, but he is someone with real expertise in a crisis. And you have written a book on the importance of expertise. What do you think Fauci's most responsible course of action is?
I think what Fauci's been doing the last few days, which is finding a way to not be there during these dog and pony shows, has probably been his best option.
Because he does interviews elsewhere, right?
Right. And I think it's been ridiculous for people to try to provoke Fauci and Birx into criticizing governors or the president, because there's just no upside in it. That'll be what the president focuses on. You know, Fauci and Birx, very clearly to me, are just trying to get through these briefings. They just want to get them over with. Now, Birx shows up, but remember, Birx is a political appointee. She was Pence's nominee to this thing. And of course, people are going after her about that. But I would remind people, it was Barack Obama who elevated her to ambassadorial rank. She's been in the U.S. government for 35 years, going on 40 years at this point. So, you know, she's a no kidding expert. The people who say, well, they should just kind of renegade generals during Vietnam or something, they should just pull their stars off and throw them on the table and walk out. That's not going to solve anything in the middle of a national health crisis. You would rather have Tony Fauci there than walking out and having some poor guy have to take over his institute and start from scratch, mm-hmm. and with the notion that the president is looking over his shoulder and could try to force him out. I think people want drama. The other day, Birx was asked if she agreed with the governor of South Carolina. That was a for your Star Trek fans out there, that's the Kobayashi Maru test of questions. That is a no-win scenario. If she says, no, the governor is wrong, the headline is, you know, Birx versus governor of South Carolina. If she says, no, I don't think that's up to him, Birx is just a political suck-up. That was one of the few times I thought the media should just kind of lay off these gotcha questions.
Gotcha.
Because there's just no upside in it.
And the late Molly Ivins used to say she didn't blame voters for the mess the country was in. She blamed corrupt leaders who exploit the voters. You seem to train your fire on voters sometimes as well. Do you disagree? Yes?
Absolutely. Molly Ivins is wrong, and I'm right. you know, we're... We're voters. I mean, this is within our power. You know, one of my common expressions, one of the lines I use the most often is, who keeps putting these terrible people in there? Ask the voters. you do. You keep voting for these people. You know, the number of people who came up to me when I was writing about the 2016 election, and they kept saying, how did we end up with such a terrible choice? And I would just point at them and say, you did this. You know, this is part of how, you know, American voters, I mean, part of the problem is American voters, and I'll get off this soapbox, but American voters have become very transactional. They want what they want, and they don't want a lot of guff about it. They just want, you know, their elected leaders to tell them that they can have what they can have, and there's no cost. And yes, to some extent, in that way, Molly Ivins was right, that political leaders have figured out how to massage us into accepting those answers. Mm-hmm. But the example I always use on the road is the people who called their congressman, and there were many of them, and I think you and I may have even talked about this when I was up there with you, the people who call their congressman and say, I want you to repeal Obamacare, but I want you to keep the Affordable Care Act, are, to me, emblematic of the problem in American politics.
You did say yesterday on social media that you think there is something that looks, I don't know if unique is the right word, about Trump support, which is, you called it the crab bucket mentality. That
yes.
you amplified someone else's tweet saying, for Trump fans, their most telling trait is this. They vote to hurt others, even if they're not gaining anything themselves. Very different from usual political tug of war over the distribution of benefits and costs. Pure malice, gratuitous cruelty. And you said, yes, this is the crab bucket mentality. I don't care if my life gets any better as long as I can think that yours is getting worse, end quote. That is some really dark stuff.
We are a country now where a large amount of our politics, and I think this is because we are so connected. It's not just social media, but it's the connectivity, the amount of media we take in the course of a day. We are a country where a huge amount of our politics is driven by social resentment. I tell the story very often of a friend of mine who was a very strong Trump voter. He graduated from high school a bit arduously. He had a few brushes with the law, but he got a high school diploma, eventually found a job, had a house, put two kids through college, and had a boat. And he turned to me in 2016 and he said, you know, Tom, things just have to change. And I exploded. I said, your life worked out better than you could possibly have imagined. And what he really meant is he just felt like other people were still getting over on him, and that there were, you know, too many Hispanics in our hometown, and that there were people who were living a good life and, you know, not working as hard as he was. And, you know, I mean, I call it the phenomenon of the Trump voter on a boat, saying, you know, life screwed me over. And it really is remarkable, the degree. And there is an analog of this on the left. There were a lot of people, particularly in the hardcore Bernie group. And by the way, in 2016, at least 1 in 10 Bernie voters went over to Trump in the general election, which tells you something really scary about American politics, who really feel that, you know, other people are living a better life and gaining an advantage over them in some way. Politico captured this with a headline, and your listeners can find it, about Johnstown, Youngstown, Ohio, where they said something to the effect of, the headline was something to the effect of, the voters here know that Trump wasn't going to help them. They love him anyway. And you could see them basically saying, we just want to make other people uncomfortable because we're very unhappy right now. That is not the American way. That is really a feature of kind of late 20th, early 20th century voting, and it's going to destroy our democracy if we don't get past it.
Tom Nichols, the author of The Death of Expertise, with us after our only short break. Your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, New York State's unemployment insurance program has been a mess during the pandemic. Leaders say they've got it straightened out. A lot of workers say, not yet, you don't. We're going to talk about what's going on the state level and on the federal level. The SBA ran out of money more quickly than Congress probably thought they would, and now there are lawsuits alleging that the banks have rigged it. We'll talk to business owners and workers about what they're dealing with next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Hey, briefly, I want to let you know about an opportunity for you to engage with local medical research about COVID-19. It's a program we're putting on Thursday night at 8 p.m. I'm going to host a community forum with scientists from the University of Rochester Medical Center and also Rochester Regional Health. They're really at the forefront of vaccine development and treatment of COVID-19. So we're going to be talking about the path toward a vaccine. There's a trial of remdesivir going on, and they are in the thick of it here. So if you've got questions about vaccine development, timetables, what's realistic, what life might look like between now and then, we're going to try to cover all of that Thursday night. And we want to know what's important to you, so you can send your questions to forum@wxxi.org. Forum@wxxi.org. Phone number for you to call with questions for the Thursday night program is 585-209-3180. 209-3180. You can post them on Twitter and Facebook tagging WXXI News. And again, the forum is WXXI's live forum, Fighting COVID-19. It's going to be on WXXI TV, AM 1370. Stream it on WXXI News Facebook page and the website. A tremendous panel of scientists and researchers, tons of expertise, as our guest would appreciate. 8 p.m. Thursday night. And briefly, before I jump to your phone calls, some listeners have been emailing the program asking, hey, WXXI, you're not carrying the Trump briefings live. What's going on with that? I just want to let you know we are following NPR's guidance on this. NPR has decided that unless it has the resources to provide analysis and fact-check throughout a briefing, they will not carry them live. NPR feels that fact-checking is essential so misinformation is not spread to the public. That's NPR's decision. We are following that one. All right. Jim and Irondequoit on the phone. Go ahead, Jim.
You guys are forcing me to do what I hate doing, and that's defend Trump. I agree with most of the things that you say about, you know, from a psychological evaluation standpoint. However, I think that the clip that you played was not a good example of that. And I think if you re-listen to it, at least this is what I got out of it, you'll hear a reporter asking a question and Trump repeatedly answering and being interrupted. And when he finally gets a little annoyed at being interrupted, poses a question to her, which she doesn't want to answer. And then at that point, he gets frustrated and says, all right, you know, I've had enough of this. I don't understand why it's become acceptable for reporters to interrupt a president when he's been asked a question while he's answering. Am I missing something?
Stay there. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, you are missing something. First, this is not new. I am old enough to remember Sam Donaldson shouting questions at Ronald Reagan across the lawn while he was walking. I mean, this was like a regular thing in the 1980s where, the president would. I don't think that was.
Jim, you're interrupting Tom.
Right. You're interrupting my
answer. Oh, my gosh.
Exactly the way.
A good example.
Well, you know, there. You have to let me finish a sentence first.
Okay, go ahead.
You know, aside from the fact that, you know, that interrupting presidents in press conferences, is a time-honored tradition. First of all, you should watch these things to see it visually. Second, one of the things that if you watch these as often as I have, he regularly interrupts the reporters before they're done with the question.
Yep.
So that he picks off the part of it right at the start. And in this case, he started answering a different question with a completely inaccurate. It wasn't a lie. Although he has told a lot of lies during these press conferences, he started trying to hijack the question away from where she was going. She did her job by saying, "No, you didn't shut off immigration or travel from China. You shut off the ability of Chinese nationals to come here." And, you know, he gets mad because she's caught him on something that he's trying not to answer. He does this with everyone, but he particularly does it with female reporters. And if you watch these, you will see him do it, and you will see the body language. He holds his hand up. He puts the palm out, and he says, hey, relax, relax. You know, in this very condescending way. Look, if you can't handle a two-hour press conference, don't have them. Because he's just freelancing. He's just riffing off the top of his head. And it's not the job of a reporter to sit there quietly, finish half a question, let him completely riff on something that isn't true, and then say, thank you, sir. That is not the job of a reporter. That is not how anybody treated Reagan. It's certainly not how anybody treated Bush. Certainly not. I was working in the Senate during the first Gulf War. Certainly not how anybody treated Bush 41 or Bush 43. Or even Bill Clinton. The only president that's gotten away with a certain amount of the deference, I think, has been President Obama. But, you know, in that case, he had people sitting in the middle of the State of the Union address calling him a liar and yelling at him. So this is, you know, to me, this is just the classic kind of defensiveness of the president about being called out. You know, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. That's your job. This is a national emergency. This reporter is asking you something, and you don't have the right to hijack the question and answer something else. She was well within her rights to ask him, and he kept interrupting her because he didn't want her to finish that question. I think if you see it visually and you see him do it enough times, you realize this is not a one-off, and it's not just women. He does it to everybody. He went after John Roberts the other day from Fox, an outlet he used to like, quite aggressively as he and he does the same thing with CNN. Everything he answers to CNN ends with a finger point that says fake news. The only person in that room he likes is Chanel Rion from One America News, who always throws him a softball. He lets her finish. He answers any way he wants to, and she smiles and says, thank you. That is not the job of a journalist. Those are not real journalists. The woman from CBS, in my view, did her job.
All right, we got a lot. We'll get, try to move as fast as we can. Jim in Penfield. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi. First off, way, way back in the, when the campaign started for 2016, I couldn't believe that the papers were printing everything this guy said. They were giving him billions and billions of free advertising. It was like, I know the basic rules of journalism are who, what, when, where, why, and how. Well, he lied again today, pretty much covered it, but that's not what they did. And I agree with the guest today. It's what, you know, this death of expertise. But what I'm afraid of, I wish we could prove it. Like, you know, we see Trump's popularity go back to 43. It never really goes below that. If him being on every day would have eroded that number, I'd be all for letting them talk. But I'm concerned because in Russia, nobody knows what the truth is anymore. There is so much propaganda that it's so frustrating. They don't even bother trying to find it anymore. And that's what I'm afraid of by letting him on every day and just, you know, he's got that thing. The more times you tell a lie, it becomes the truth.
All right, so let's let Tom jump on that. Go ahead, Tom.
That's a really legitimate worry, and I think part of what the way Trump handles the media is not to get any particular story out. It is to make you give up. This is one of the reasons I'm being so stubborn about listening to these things, because I think Trump is just trying to exhaust us all into not listening and to just kind of taking his word at any given moment. I mean, it is really remarkable that Trump on one day will say, I did X, and on the next day he says, I didn't do X. And his followers, you know, they have, as a woman at the Washington Post, Alexandra Petri, wrote a great piece about him, said they're like goldfish. They have no memory of 10 minutes ago. And he gets away with that. And I take the caller's point that this is just free media. I think that happened in 2016 in part because the media didn't take him seriously and they thought it was just a kind of good carnival show, a dog and pony show. And I think because some of them were, hoping that he would be the nominee and that would make him an easy kill for Hillary Clinton. I think that insofar as the media, you know, had a bias that was at work in 2016, they were kind of snickering and saying, won't it be great when this guy gets the nomination because Clinton will just, you know, torch him completely. And I think now they're trying to correct in the other direction. But I still think there's a difference between a candidate and the president of the United States. Everything the president says is policy, whether you like it or not, and somebody has to be paying attention to it and report it.
Don in East Rochester. Go ahead, Don.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a comment and a question. My comment is that I agree that President Trump should be broadcast for his press conferences, no matter how long they take, so that the American people can see what kind of idiot, how unfocused he is, how he's the worst president that the United States has ever had that I can imagine. And I would like to see the American people to see this on television so that they can make him the Herbert Hoover of the 21st century, because he is totally incapable of responding to this pandemic and to this economic crisis which is coming on. My question is that I was listening to Andrew Cuomo on Friday when President Trump tweeted something.
Yeah,
that,
they kind of went after each other, yep.
Well, the question I want to know is that, now remember, I'm a little technologically behind, but do the networks broadcast Andrew Cuomo nationwide?
Yeah, so let me just jump in, Don, because we're out of time. CNN does, and yeah, a lot of them do now. Go ahead, Tom. What do you think? What do you think of Cuomo's daily briefings in comparison?
You know, I mean, he's not my governor, so you know the people of New York have to make that judgment. I like them. I think he is, you know, pretty upfront. You know, they show a very human side. Sometimes he gets irritated. Sometimes he is humorous. They don't bother me, and I think they're actually useful, especially for New Yorkers. So I don't watch them because I have a governor, and I watch her and try and keep up with what's going on in my own state. But I've watched some of his briefings. I think they're fine, and you can find them online. I mean, your caller said he's not technologically advanced, but if you have a computer or a laptop and an internet connection, it'll only take you about 5 minutes to get this. So you can stay informed.
30 seconds. John in Rochester wants to know from you, why is the president's base as solid as it is?
Well, this goes back to that question about social resentment. They're not really getting anything from him. They are just enjoying the show. They're enjoying that other people are unhappy about it. I mean, I've had Trump voters say to me, as long as he's making you unhappy, he's okay with me. I've had people say that to me, right to my face.
But don't you think that's because they don't trust Democrats or anybody to actually make their lives better after all these years?
It's possible, but they aren't really demanding anything of the person they elected either, other than a show. And I think that shows a lack of seriousness about politics.
Tom's book is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters, which will turn out to be one of the most important books written in this century. And that's why we occasionally drag him back onto this program. I know it's a busy time. I mean, it's a little less busy, but it is always busy for you, and we appreciate the time, Tom. Let's talk again soon.
Thank you so much for having me, Evan.
Tom Nichols, Radio Free Tom, if you want to follow him on social media and get his take on the daily briefings, because he will be there watching whether you are or not. More connections coming up.